content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the April 2023 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from Education Week titled, "Districts Say Social Media is Hurting Students' Mental Health, Now They're Suing," by Ariana Prothero, posted April 13th, 2023. A growing number of school districts are following the lead of the Seattle Public Schools and suing major social media companies over the deteriorating mental health of their students. Their argument, that these companies have designed highly addictive apps and marketed their products to kids who are uniquely susceptible to manipulation. School districts, meanwhile, have been left to deal with the fallout from the harm those apps are doing to students' mental health, the lawsuits argue. While legal experts are skeptical that these lawsuits will succeed in the court of law, in the court of public opinion, they may have more success. Essentially, schools are saying, look at what's happening to our youth, and you, the social media companies, are responsible, said Robert Hachia, a Kansas State University education professor and a former school administrator who is an expert in education law. There's no question there is a problem. The issue is, how can social media companies be assigned some kind of liability for this problem? It's not really about the money, he said. It's about getting them to change their practices. The Seattle district broke new legal ground when it filed a lawsuit in January against the major social media companies, ByteDance, which owns TikTok, Google, which owns YouTube, Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, Snap, which owns Snapchat, and Twitter. King County, where the Seattle School District is located, has seen an increase in suicides, attempted suicides, and mental health-related emergency room visits among school-age kids, according to the complaint. The number of students in the school system saying they feel so sad or hopeless almost every day for 2 weeks or more in a row that they stopped doing some usual activities went up 30% in the decade since 2009, which is about the time the use of smartphones to access social media began to take off for teens and young adults. Students who are suffering from anxiety, depression, and other mental health challenges do worse in school and are more likely to act out in class or skip it altogether, which impacts the ability of schools to fulfill their mission, the Seattle lawsuit argues. Rising mental health problems among students also put more pressure on school resources, forcing districts to divert money away from academics and toward hiring mental health professionals and staff who are trained to identify and work with children in crisis. The lawsuit asks for financial compensation for the school district and for the courts to declare the practices of social media companies a public nuisance under Washington state law. Education Week reached out to the social media companies named in the complaint, but only heard back from Google by the time this article was published. We have heavily invested in creating safe experiences for children across our platforms and have introduced strong protections and dedicated features to prioritize their well-being, a Google spokesperson said in a statement to Education Week. For example, through FamilyLink, we provide parents with the ability to set reminders, limit screen time, and block specific types of content on supervised devices. Subsection: Experts cite weaknesses in the legal arguments by school districts. Now, at least 9 additional school districts and municipalities in Arizona, California, New Jersey, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Washington State have filed similar suits, according to local media reports. And that number is poised to grow as at least 5 other school districts are weighing whether to file their own lawsuits or join existing ones. But drawing the connection between social media, student mental health, and who is responsible is not necessarily straightforward, experts say. Providing recommendations of videos you might watch, providing social media services where people can communicate with each other, is generally protected by the First Amendment, said Eugene Volokh, a law professor at UCLA and a specialist on First Amendment law. the government generally can't impose liability on publishers for supposedly publishing materials that causes some of the users to be psychologically harmed. You can't sue a movie studio for putting out a movie that is bad for some small fraction of the audience. The fact that this case involves minors likely won't matter, said Volokh, because children have First Amendment rights too. He said the Seattle complaint stresses that social media companies design their algorithms and platforms to increase engagement and use. While the complaint argues that doing so manipulates vulnerable young minds, Volokh said there is another way of looking at it. That's just saying that they work hard to provide a product that their users really like. In the case of the Seattle lawsuit, Volokh said getting these practices labeled a public nuisance doesn't provide social media companies with clear rules of what content or business practices are and are not allowed. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the New York Daily News, and it's titled, SUNY Drops SAT, ACT Requirement for Admissions as Fewer Students Take the Tests, by Kayla Bamberger, posted April 14, 2023. The State University of New York will no longer order its 64 campuses to require standardized exams for college admissions as the number of test takers dwindles across the state. The SUNY Board of Trustees, consisting of 18 members mostly appointed by the governor, unanimously approved a resolution on Tuesday afternoon to prospectively make the submission of SAT or ACT exam scores optional, as first reported by Politico. The policy was first implemented as a pandemic emergency measure in June 2020 and extended each year for limited terms until this week. While applicants can still submit standardized test scores if they so choose, close to 40,000 fewer high school graduates in New York took the SAT last year than before the pandemic, according to data from the College Board. Colleges in New York State and across the country are largely maintaining their test optional policies and or implementing them permanently, SUNY Chancellor John King said in a resolution. That includes Columbia University, which became the first Ivy League institution to drop the requirement last month. The liberal arts college Vassar College in Poughkeepsie followed suit on Thursday. Other public universities, such as colleges in the University of California system, have scrapped test scores entirely from consideration for admissions or merit scholarships. In addition, fewer New York State high school students are taking the SAT, especially among historically underrepresented groups, read the SUNY memo. Fewer than 6 in 10 New York students who graduated high school last year took the SAT, according to College Board data. Before the pandemic and the proliferation of test optional policies as an emergency measure, nearly 8 in 10 graduates statewide sat for the admissions test during high school. The report shows 122,170 members of the class of 2022 took the exam before graduation, 39% of whom were white. One-third of them came from families earning more than $110,000 each year. SUNY will continue to study the use and value of standardized tests through its public policy research arm, the Rockefeller Institute of Government, and tweak the policy if necessary. But officials so far found that students who did not submit SAT or ACT scores are keeping pace with their peers. Importantly, King said in the memo, during the period that exam submission has been optional at SUNY, the retention rate gap between test takers and non-test takers has stayed the same or even shrunk. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, A Well of Conservative Support for Public Schools in Rural Texas. A national movement to give parents public vouchers to spend on private schools has run up against the deep loyalty Texas has always had for its public schools, by J. David Goodman, posted April 14, 2023. New Home, Texas. Bright yellow uprights tower over what was once recently a flat expanse of cotton fields, now transformed into football turf. Nearby cranes pull up the walls of what will soon be a new elementary school. Not too long ago, you could count on two hands the number of annual graduates from the New Home Independent School District. Now, families are flocking to the windswept patch of West Texas just south of Lubbock, drawn to the deeply conservative farming community by the promise of good public schools. What's keeping this place together is the school, said Ramon Benitez, 39, an agriculture science teacher at New Home. Amid a growing national movement to give parents public money to spend on private schools, it is in places like New Home, where the football coach is a local fixture, and students learn both how to read and how to judge the quality of a cut of meat, that the conservative campaign has run up against the real politic of rural Texas. The school voucher movement, which seeks to direct public money to private or religious schools, has rapidly gained steam in conservative states as parents battle public schools over books in the libraries, the teaching of race and racism, and transgender issues. More than a dozen states have adopted some form of school vouchers. This year, several, including Florida, Iowa, and Utah, voted to create expansive new programs open to all students, an approach pioneered in Arizona. But Texas has been an outlier so far, in large part because of the long-standing support for public schools in deep red communities like New Home. In far-flung districts around the state, parents and educators have defended their schools, which are often the biggest local employer and the center of community life. Rural Republicans in the Texas State House have long voted with Democrats, who represent larger urban schools, to prevent any changes that could reduce the money available for public schools, frequently the only ones available in small, rural districts. But that bipartisan resistance has found itself under increasing strain this year, as lawmakers in Austin have become caught up in the fraught national politics of public education. Governor Greg Abbott has been leading the charge, backing legislation that would give public money to parents for private or homeschooling expenses. Parents are angry about the woke agenda that is being forced on their children in their schools, Mr. Abbott said during an event to promote education savings accounts last month at a Christian school in Bryan, Texas. Our schools are for education, not indoctrination. The governor has made the issue the centerpiece of his third term early on, crisscrossing the state to rally support in more than a dozen exclusively Christian schools. The state's powerful Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is also a strong backer, as are deep-pocketed Republican donors unafraid to back primary challenges to Republicans who do not support their priorities. If approved, the money could go to religious schools. An even further step is under consideration in Oklahoma, where the State Board of Education on Tuesday was discussing possible approval of what would be the nation's first religious charter school. Districts get better when there are more options available to parents, said Michael Barba of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a conservative think tank supporting Mr. Abbott's efforts, and that also holds true in rural Texas. The push follows years of acrimonious school board hearings around the country and a raft of legislation subjecting public schools to new rules for lessons and books. The debate in Texas comes amid increasingly aggressive efforts by state officials to oversee the direction of public schools, which are independently managed at the local level by elected school boards. In March, the Texas Education Agency announced it would take over Houston's public schools, superseding the local school board and ousting its superintendent, citing failures at one of the district's high schools. In Austin, the agency has moved to install a state conservator to monitor special education. At the Capitol, the fight over vouchers has reached a critical stage. Last week, the state Senate passed a bill creating a voucher program to provide $8,000 in taxpayer money per year for students who opt out of public school. That was countered by the state House, which passed a budget amendment on the same day with Democrat and Republican votes to bar state funding of a voucher program. Though the amendment was unlikely to survive into the final budget, the State House vote signaled that many rural Republicans remained skeptical of school vouchers and set the stage for a tense final showdown in the coming weeks. The governor is putting a lot of pressure, a lot of state officials are putting pressure on those rural Republicans, said Mark Henry, the superintendent of the Cypress-Fairbanks School District, outside of Houston and the largest suburban district in Texas. We just hope they hold the line. The Senate voucher bill also included a prohibition on the teaching of sexual orientation or gender identity at all levels of public school, similar to the restrictions passed last year in Florida, a provision that directly connects the fight over education content to the fight over funding. The governor's aides point to polls showing support for school choice, even among rural Republicans, though opponents argue that such numbers are dependent on how the question is framed. "There's no groundswell for this in my district," said State Representative Travis Clardy, a Republican who represents rural counties in East Texas. He voted against vouchers last week. In New Home, nearly 400 miles northwest of Austin, parents said they were not yet seeing the issue as a threat. "Let's say they did this," said Kayla Ferguson, a Republican who owns The Spot, a recently renovated small restaurant by the school, where her three daughters are students. "It wouldn't be something where they wouldn't have public schools, right?" Martina Torres, a parent who works at the restaurant, chimed in from behind the counter. "To me, the big scare would be if so many parents chose to go with that decision, and it would cut the money for the public school," she said. "I don't like the idea," Ms. Ferguson said. "I would never send my kids to a private school." Unlike many rural districts where the public schools are the only nearby options, New Home is close enough to the city of Lubbock that parents could choose to send their children to nearby private schools at their own expense. Instead, the opposite has been taking place. Many parents unhappy with the public schools in Lubbock have been moving to New Home instead of enrolling their children in private schools. Others remain in Lubbock but drive their children 25 miles each way to school. Enrollment is soaring. Many say they are transferring from more politically and culturally diverse Lubbock in search of smaller classes and a place where the values more closely align with their own. "We've doubled and doubled again," Shane Fiedler, the superintendent of the New Home District, said of the school population, which is now more than 630 students. New Home is a particular kind of rural place, one that has been rapidly transforming into a suburb, its dusty landscape now dotted with sprawling modern farmhouse or ranch-style homes and signs advertising lots for sale. Its official population is a little more than 300, though many families enrolled in the schools live outside of the city limits. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, "Supreme Court Allows $6 Billion Student Loan Debt Settlement. The justices declined to intervene over a class action settlement that could lead to the cancellation of more than 200,000 loans based on claims that colleges misled students." This article was posted April 13, 2023, by Lawrence Hurley. "A settlement that will allow thousands of student loan debts to be canceled will go into effect after the Supreme Court on Thursday declined to block it. The Supreme Court, in a brief order, rejected a request made by colleges challenging the settlement. The case is unrelated to President Joe Biden's broader effort to forgive student loan debt, which is also before the justices, with a ruling due in the next 2 months. The class action settlement concerns loans that borrowers claim should be canceled because they were taken out based on misrepresentations made by their schools, many of which are for profit. The settlement could be worth more than $6 billion. The case arises from a settlement that California-based U.S. District Judge William Alsup approved in November in a case brought by borrowers. The government has already started implementing the settlement. The application at the Supreme Court was filed by Everglades College, Lincoln Educational Services Corps, and American National University. Lincoln and American National are for-profit enterprises, while Everglades is not for-profit. All three operate colleges the federal government placed on a list of more than 150 institutions that it said are linked with claims of, quote, substantial misconduct. The colleges object to that characterization. The Justice Department says about 3,800 of the affected loans involve the three colleges, and approximately 400 of them have already been discharged. The Federal Higher Education Act allows debt cancellations in specific circumstances, but the challengers say Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has exceeded his authority. The Secretary's claimed authority amounts to nothing less than the power to cancel en masse every student loan in the country, the challenger said in court papers. They asked the Supreme Court to put Alsup's ruling on hold and consider hearing the case on an accelerated basis. The Justice Department, representing Cardona, said in court papers that the settlement only involves borrowers and the Education Department. As a result, it neither adjudicates any rights or imposes any duties or liabilities upon the relevant schools, and there is no evidence the schools have suffered any injury, the government's lawyers argued. Alsup refused the college's request to delay his ruling from going into effect, saying their inclusion on the list of colleges did not affect their rights or have any legally binding impact on them. The lawsuit was filed in 2019, 4 years after the collapse of Corinthian Colleges, a for-profit organization which led thousands of borrowers to file claims seeking to discharge their debt. In the separate cases involving Biden's much larger debt relief plan, the Supreme Court in February appeared skeptical that it was lawful. The program, which would allow eligible borrowers to cancel up to $20,000 in debt, has been blocked since the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a temporary hold in October, and there are major doubts it will ever go into effect. That plan, which would cost more than $400 billion and affect upward of 40 million borrowers, is significantly broader than the class action settlement. The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, Higher Ed Leaders Have Largely Kept Mum About Anti-DEI Bills. A New Campaign Changes That. This article was posted by Aaliyah Wong on USA Today on April 14, 2023. In the past couple of years, the country has seen a spate of legislation targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts and perceived liberal bias at educational institutions. Initially focused largely on K-12 schools, the legislation has increasingly gone after colleges and universities. Last year, nearly half of the bills targeted higher education, according to the free speech and literary organization PEN America. Higher education leaders have tried to stay above the fray, but in news shared exclusively with USA Today, more than 100 former college presidents are banding together, pushing back against recent bills and policies in a campaign they hope will become a national movement. The campaign, which will be spearheaded by Penn and the civic engagement-focused nonprofit Campus Compact, kicks off Friday with a signed statement. But for many signatories, that's just the first step, said Penn's Jeremy Young. The former presidents will go on to engage in op-eds and other communication pushes and network with key leaders in industries ranging from the military to medicine, among other strategies. Their status as retired or former presidents is key, Young said. Previously, advocates had failed to convince sitting presidents to speak out publicly over fears that lawmakers would penalize them with funding cuts. The 117 and counting signatories include a winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, a former Republican congressman and lieutenant governor, and recent leaders of massive university systems in states from Montana to Maryland. They represent 36 states total. No one has ever done anything like this, Young said. The goal is to have these prestigious figures with lifetimes of experience in higher education and in communicating about it build support for maintaining it as a place of intellectual freedom. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, Rutgers Historic Strike is Suspended on Tentative Deal. Classes will resume Monday after the first strike in Rutgers University's 257-year history, by Pranshu Verma, posted April 15, 2023. Rutgers University's historic academic worker strike is suspended after unions reached a tentative contract deal with school officials, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said on Saturday. After 5 days of tense negotiation and intervention from Murphy's office, the university and academic workers reached a framework agreement that was announced Saturday morning. Strikers will go back to work immediately, union officials said. Classes will resume Monday, according to Murphy. This fair and amicable conclusion respects the interests of many different stakeholders and puts an end to a standoff that was disruptive to our educators and students alike, Murphy said in a statement. The strike began Monday and came after the unions, which represent nearly 9,000 workers across three campuses, said they had failed to reach a contract agreement with university administration after nearly a year of bargaining. It was the first strike in the history of Rutgers University, founded in 1766, and caused disruption for its 67,000 students, some of whom saw classes canceled or nearly empty. The unions were fighting for a salary increase that kept up with inflation, job security, including longer contracts for untenured faculty, a living wage for teaching assistants, and race and gender equity initiatives, among other demands. Jonathan Holloway, president of Rutgers University, announced Saturday the provisions in the framework agreement. Full-time faculty and counselors will receive salary increases across the board by at least 14% by July 1, 2025. Part-time lecturers will get a 43.8% increase in per-class credit salary over the course of 4 years, according to the university. Minimum salaries for postdoctoral fellows and associates will increase by 27.9% over the same period. teaching and graduate assistants will see their 10-month salaries increase to $40,000 over the course of their contract. Contracts are retroactive to July 1, 2022, university officials said. The tentative agreement will have to be ratified by members in a secret ballot, union officials said, cautioning that there are still open issues that need to be resolved. And we'll cut that article short for time. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's titled, Office for Civil Rights Changes Approach to Complaints Amid Record High Volume. A mediation option now offered to all as an alternative to investigations is among methods helping to move cases along. Published April 14, 2023, posted by Naz Modan. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights saw a record number of complaints logged last year, stretching resources thin for the agency's civil rights enforcement arm and keeping it from addressing complaints as quickly as possible. In fiscal year 2021, the OCR received more than 5,200 K-12 discrimination complaints, and 2022 surpassed that number. We saw a very high volume of complaints come in last year, the highest that we've ever seen in the history of the Office for Civil Rights, said Catherine Lehman, Assistant Secretary for the Office for Civil Rights. And so we are operating under a crushing workload for our staff and trying to triage to address the complaints and to move as quickly and as effectively as we can. Some of the staff are juggling caseloads of up to 48 cases per person. And that is an untenable caseload, Lehman said in an interview Thursday with K-12 Dive. It's very, very worrisome for me. Section called COVID-19, Disabilities, Race, LGBTQ, Top Caseloads. That increased caseload will be reflected in the 2022 annual report set to be released by the end of April, a department spokesperson said. Just like in previous years, the majority of complaints received are related to disability, said Lehman, who also led the OCR under the Obama administration. However, many such cases, and other complaints generally, that the office saw in 2022 and beyond are also related to the COVID-19 pandemic. There's heightened awareness now about the need for compensatory services for students with disabilities if they have been unable to receive services that they are entitled to because of their disability in the COVID context, said Lehman, and how best to ensure that those students are fully served now. Other cases born out of the pandemic range from complaints around mask wearing to the availability of services during remote learning and concerns about student health and well-being. In line with numerous state laws passed in recent years limiting discussion around gender, sexuality, and race-related topics, OCR has also experienced a high volume of complaints around racial harassment, gender identity, and sexual orientation issues in schools. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.